Case is submitted. We'll hear arguments next in the city of Rome against the United States. I think you may proceed when you're ready.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, I represent the City of Rome and two of its citizens in a Section 5 matter, which is somewhat broader than a Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act 1965 matter. The City of Rome is a city of some 30,000 persons, which lies 65 miles or so northwest of Atlanta, Georgia. I am on my 23rd visit to the city of Washington in an effort to get preclearance of my city's growth and government under Section 5, the preclearance provision of the Voting Rights Act, a provision which we here challenge. The city of Rome is governed by a council-manager form of government which has been elected at large since 1918. In 1966, during a time when, or soon after, this court's reapportionment cases, and during those reapportionment cases, the city attorney, upon request from the then governing council, recommended to the city council that certain changes needed to be made as he understood the reapportionment cases as they existed at that time. The reason for his recommendation was the city of Rome was divided into 9 wards of very disparate size. And even though the city council was elected at large, there was a residency requirement. At that time, there was a case pending under the title of Douche v. Davis in the lower court where that system of government had been challenged. And that ultimately made this court, and it was reversed. But at that time, the law was in question. The city attorney recommended that certain provisions of the charter of the city of Rome be changed at that time, among which were the ward situation should be changed from 9 to 3, and at the same time, some house cleaning matters in the government should be also changed. As of that time in 1964, the Georgia Election Code required a majority vote, and although that code did not specifically apply to municipalities in Georgia, it did serve as an unofficial guide for local charters. He recommended that majority vote be instituted, and noting that there was a tendency from time to time for both the county government and the city government to be swept completely out of office, he recommended, in order to assure some continuity of government, that staggered terms be instituted. And the staggered terms, the best way to set them up would be to provide for numbered posts. He also, to make consistent the charter with respect to the city commission and the board of education, recommended that residency requirements be instituted for the Board of Education as they were required for the City Commission, so that these electoral changes, which were made in 1966 by the Georgia legislature, were the majority vote, numbered posts, staggered terms, and a residency requirement for the Board of Education.
And reduction of 9 wards to 3?
And reduction of 9 wards to 3.
With the Commissioner Council now still elected at large and still the same number of members, but a requirement that they reside, some of them reside in each of the three wards.
That is correct. These changes took place, and it is important to note that at the same time these changes took place, on the state front, on the general state law front, the Georgia Municipal Election Code in 1968, which also contained majority vote provision and a numbered post provision, for statewide application was submitted to the Attorney General and pre-cleared. It is also important to note that when the changes of the City of Rome were made, it was prior to this Court's decision in Allen versus Board of Elections, in Perkins versus Matthews, and quite a while prior to, in fact, 5 years prior to the time that the Attorney General even had regulations governing the manner in which submissions under Section 5 were to be made. The City of Rome in 1974 had an annexation of a rather large, at least for the City of Rome, section over its objection, that is, over the city government's objection. It was imposed upon them by the state legislature because of a great need of sewer services within this island in the City of Rome. It was an island, the City of Rome surrounded an unincorporated area, so that over the actual objection of the Rome City Commission, the state of Georgia, the local legislative delegation, imposed the annexation of that area on the city. It was a state law by which that annexation took place, although annexation can also take place by ordinance. In 1974, that annexation was submitted to the Attorney General by the then city attorney. The Attorney General wrote back and said that he could not pre-clear it until he learned about the city government and what it was like, whereupon the city provided additional information as to what the city, how the city was structured, and that included the 1966 electoral changes. The Attorney General then refused to pre-clear both that annexation and the electoral changes. And in addition, he had inquired about the number of annexations which had occurred since 1964. There were a total of 60 annexations which had taken place during a 10-year period.
And these annexations had been by way of ordinance or by way of legislation in the state legislature?
Four of them had been state legislature and
the balance
by ordinance.
Ordinance.
That's correct. So that after the exchange between the city attorney and the Attorney General of the United States, there remained the unprecleared electoral changes and 13 of the annexations. In the meantime, the City of Rome had conducted some 5 or 6 elections under the changes which they had made in 1966, including the staggered terms provision, so that there were members right in the middle of their terms. It was determined, as of the objection time, that no further elections were feasible under the then existing interplay of federal and state law, so that no election has been held in Rome since 1974.
What is it, except for this situation? Is it a biennial election every 2 years?
Yes, sir. I believe it's every 4 years.
Every 4 years?
Yes, sir.
And the terms of, at first, I guess, were of differing lengths to introduce the staggered term.
That's correct, to initiate the staggered term.
Thereafter, they were 4-year terms?
That's correct. Mm-hmm. Whereupon the City of Rome filed suit in the only jurisdiction in which you can file suit, the District Court of the District of Columbia, to seek not only a review of the Attorney General's actions or the constitutionality of the Attorney General's actions, but bailout. And at which time it also challenged the constitutionality of Section 5 and also asked that it be permitted to bail out under Section 4 of the Voting Rights Act. The District Court of the District of Columbia made many findings of fact to which I commend this Court for its careful reading, which we have itemized in the brief, and shown that there have been some 18 particular findings which are characterized according to the Zimmer standards under Zimmer versus McKeven, the city of Rome took the position that in order to carry its burden of proving no purpose and no effect, that the Zimmer standards were applicable, at least were a guide by which they could prove the lack of discriminatory effect in the changes and annexations. The court below found that there was not, had not been used in the city of Rome, any literacy test for the 17-year period required by the Act. The court also found no past discrimination. The court also found a total access to the political process. And to quote the court, it said that the city officials of Rome were quite responsive to the needs of the minorities. And most remarkably, with respect to the political power of minorities in the city of Rome, I quote the specific findings of the court below, blacks often hold the balance of power in Rome elections, and in Rome politics, the black community, if it chooses to vote as a group, can probably determine the outcome of many, if not most, contests. The many others detailing and generalizing the findings as to the representation provided by the city of Rome for the minorities are set out on pages 5 through 7 of the brief. Quite frankly, I think they're remarkable, and I'm proud of my city for having conducted its own affirmative action plan. It's about what it amounts to.
Mr. Brinson, it's been a while since I read the briefs in this case. Do I recollect correctly that the population makeup of your city is about 3/4 white and 1/4 Negro?
That is correct, almost exactly. It's about 76% to 23.4%.
And has, you've read us that finding, have there been Negro office holders in the city?
There have been no elected black officials in the city of Rome. However, there's been only one black citizen who ran for office after the change times, and only one significant candidate who ran before the electoral changes were made.
Neither one was elected.
Neither one was elected. There is one appointed on the Board of Education, which is a 6-member board.
And the election was at large both before and after 1966.
That's correct. The city takes the position that among its basic positions that it did take in from the very beginning at the first instance was the unconstitutionality of the Act, and that is the power of Congress to enact a provision, that is Section 5, which permits the Attorney General or the court to deny preclearance merely on effect, because the lower court found the city of Rome completely innocent of any purposeful discrimination in any of its electoral changes or annexations. That was a specific finding by the lower court. Thus, the question is squarely presented to this court whether or not Congress indeed has the power to prescribe those changes which may have arguable discriminatory effect alone.
You say then that Section 5 of the 15th Amendment permits Congress to provide for implementation of the proscriptions of the amendment itself, but it does not permit it to enlarge the rights created by the 15th Amendment?
That is correct. We do that. We do argue that point. And that is Section 2 of the 15th Amendment, the enforcement clause.
I'm sorry, I was confusing Section 5 to 14 with Section 2.
We say that the substantive provisions of Section 1 of the 15th Amendment control just what they can enforce, that Congress can only enforce the substantive provisions of the 15th Amendment.
Of course, the court has held otherwise with respect to the 14th Amendment, hasn't it?
I don't agree that it has.
I thought it did. I didn't agree with the court, but it did so. But.
Well, we have analyzed the Katzenbach versus Morgan case.
That's the case I'm talking about.
And Oregon versus Mitchell as well. And we found that nevertheless, it is based on some rational fact-finding that in that case, what the court did was analyze what Congress had done. And Congress had specifically, with its fact-finding powers had determined that the abolition of literacy tests would, that the existence of a literacy test denied services to non-English speaking people, and that also it denied the voting rights, and that a specific way to counter that would be to prohibit the literacy test. But that was based on a fact-finding with specific reference to the literacy test itself. Literacy test, the national application of the prohibition of literacy test was also subject to that fact-finding in Oregon versus Mitchell.
Then it wouldn't have been a sufficient answer in those cases for the state or city to have come back and said the literacy tests, although they may have had discriminatory effect, were not discriminatory in purpose.
The point that we make is that, as was noted in Oregon v. Mitchell, that the substance, that there are three, as Justice Black noted in Oregon v. Mitchell, the three things that Congress can do are to enforce the substantive provisions of the Constitution and cannot strip the states of their power. Naturally, I'm going to get into that, but with reference to states, cannot strip the states of their power and can only enact appropriate legislation, appropriate with respect to the state power reserved to it. We contend that, first of all, and the question that I've not yet reached, that the 15th Amendment does prohibit only purposeful discrimination, a question which we say, I'm not sure that it has been decided. I know that it is before the court now in another case. It is also before the court in this case. But it would be, such a holding would be consistent with the court's treatment of the 14th Amendment, as reflected in the Washington v. Davis and progeny, and more recently in the Feeney case. But it is also consistent with Gamillion versus Lightfoot and the Wright case, as well as Nevitt versus Sides, a case from the Fifth Circuit. But the question becomes whether or not Congress does have the power to expand the substantive provisions of the 15th Amendment, of Section 1. If Section 1 does not proscribe innocent electoral changes, then we contend that Congress cannot proscribe innocent electoral changes, because to do so would be to expand that provision. And the appropriateness of such legislation with respect to the states, which is the test, as established
in... The idea that the only way it would be bad would be for the legislature to say, we are doing this for the express purpose of discriminating against the minority. And if they don't say that, that's it. Is that your position?
No, Mr. Justice Marshall.
Thank you.
It is not. Because the other way that has been justified is that there is some nexus or some prior discrimination. In every other voting rights case, there has been some indication of discrimination otherwise. Some prior discrimination which has a present nexus to the existing effect. And that does not exist in Rome. That was found to be excluded with respect to past discrimination. It was found that the present, it was an actual finding. It was not just a lack thereof. The city of Rome proved that there was no purpose to the satisfaction of the District Court of the District of Columbia.
The Civil Rights Act of 1964, and specifically Title Seven thereof, was enacted under the Commerce Clause power, I suppose.
I understand that it has been also to be held to be enacted under the 14th Amendment.
Well, the amendments, maybe.
Right.
Originally, I suppose, amendments. Under the Commerce power, at least arguably.
Yes, sir. Now, however, it's my understanding that this Court has never addressed the question of whether or not Title Seven can be applicable to cities or states because of the reserve power of the states, and that there is an additional consideration because of states qua states, as we're reminding in the National League of Cities case. I realize that that was a Commerce Clause case. Nevertheless, it revivified the existence of the 10th Amendment and federalism principles. I think that Fitzpatrick v. Bitzer, which was an 11th Amendment case, is not inconsistent with that holding. And that where there's application to state action or to states as states that the an additional consideration is there, and that is the federal, that is the federalism principle of the 10th Amendment and Article 4, Section 4.
It's Article 4, Section 4.
The guarantee clause.
Of the Republican form of government.
That's correct. One of the considerations, I think, that has been discussed in these cases is that, well, Congress considered the federalism principles when it enacted the statute in question. And that may be true, but I remind the Court in this case that Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act is an entirely different animal from such remedies as Title VII. It is an entirely different kind, and one that has been observed to be a vast departure from our ordinary concepts of federalism. And I would remind the Court also that it has application only to a few states. Therefore, when Congress passed Section 5, it could not have been considered to uphold federalism principles because it was applicable to only a few states. This has been particularly noted, I think, by Mr. Justice Powell, who had in his various dissents with respect to the Voting Rights Act, has noted that it is made more noxious by its applicability to a few states. The National League of Cities decision, again, although a decision involving the commerce power, points out that federalism principles prevent Congress from enacting a law that interferes with a state's separate and independent existence. We have attempted to show in our brief just how this interference has occurred. It has been a criticism for quite some time, and it was indeed a criticism on a theoretical basis in the Katzenbach case. And we're not asking this Court to rehear the Katzenbach case. We have attempted to make that clear that Katzenbach, it is clear many times from the language in Katzenbach that the Court was then addressing and that Congress was addressing purposeful discrimination. The very terms that are used throughout the Katzenbach case refer to the evil of purposeful discrimination, the contrivances of discrimination. Moreover, it was also important in South Carolina versus Katzenbach, and they noted and based their justification of Section 5 on the temporary nature of the Act. That is, the intent of Congress at the time was that it would last 5 years.
So you submit that the effect language in the section is unsupported, is unsupportable under the Constitution?
We do not, Your Honor. We have suggested to the Court a construction of the statute which would be within our argument about the constitutionality so that Congress could not be considered to have expanded the limitations on Section 1, or limitations provided by Section 1 of the 15th Amendment. That construction is that in determining whether or not an electoral...
You do argue that Congress has no power.
We do.
To prohibit electoral changes that have no discriminatory purpose.
We do indeed argue that, Your Honor, except that we argue...
And why do you argue that at all?
Because we feel that the Congress, unless the statute is interpreted the way we suggest, that it has expanded those limitations of Section 1.
So you do argue, then, that Congress had... that the effect language in Section 5, if it permits... If it forbids changes without discriminatory purpose, is unconstitutional.
No, so we argue.
Well,
we argue that
if the effect language bans changes that took place without discriminatory purpose, you say that the effect language is unconstitutional.
That's correct. Yes. To the extent that Congress so intended, or to the extent that it's been applied by the District Court of the District of Columbia.
And you say we have never held otherwise.
I don't believe this Court has. I believe that wherever this Court has had a voting rights case, it has involved purposeful discrimination.
What about beer?
In Beer, there was, it was at least noted in the dissent, that there was purposeful discrimination, that it was involved.
Well, that's nice to talk about the dissent. That was me. What about the majority?
Well, in that case, Your Honor, I think that the fact that there had been discrimination in the city, there had been a history of discrimination, but in looking to effect, the issue was not before the court at the time. But in looking at the effect, there was the cognizance that the city had had a history of racial discrimination.
We wouldn't reach a constitutional claim, I take it, if there was some non-constitutional basis upon which we could decide the case.
I believe that would be correct.
And we review the three-judge court's findings on a clearly erroneous basis?
The findings in this case would support our proposition because they are exactly and specifically that we have no discriminatory purpose.
Well, except that that necessarily includes your constitutional premise. Supposing you were to show that not only was the district court correct in finding there was no intent, but that it was wrong in showing there was no effect, that the annexations, for example, were de minimis.
Well, we do very well. That is still another argument that we make, that there is no effect under the Act.
Well, that would not require any constitutional holding on our part.
That's correct.
But that would require us to overturn the finding of the district court.
Yes, it would.
And therefore, at least we would be obliged to find that that finding was clearly erroneous, I suppose.
That's correct. And we do argue that principle. We argue, first of all, that it's unconstitutional as being an expansion of the substantive provision of the 15th Amendment. We argue that if you can construe the Act to provide that where there's purpose, then there should be no preclearance, clearly, if there is also an effect. If it's not clear whether there's purpose, then you look to the effect that exists and see if you can infer purpose. And then if there is effect alone that the without purpose, or if there can be no inference of purpose, then the provision should be pre-cleared.
Is it more fundamentally, Mr. Brinson, do you contend that this particular constitutional issue was not decided in Katzenbach, in South Carolina against Katzenbach, or are you conceding that it was decided and asking us to reconsider that decision?
It was not decided, we contend, Your Honor, because the question, first of all, was not before the court, and it is clear from the court's decision that it was considering purposeful discrimination, that those were the evils to which it was directing, to which Congress was directing the Act, and the reasons for justifying the Act were the unique circumstances existing at the time. And we contend that those unique circumstances don't exist now and did not exist at the time that the Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act was reenacted in 1975. We contend that the fact that there were unique circumstances was the way that the court justified the intrusiveness or the uniqueness of the Section 5 as a remedy.
In South Carolina against Katzenbach?
Correct.
And you're telling us now they've changed circumstances, which would imply that you're conceding that this issue was decided in Katzenbach.
No,
that's
sir.
That's what confuses me.
Well, we do not concede that issue, but
the conditions have not been changed. You're telling us that in any event, this is a new question before this court.
I am saying in any event.
Yeah.
I am saying that. Because we have several alternative approaches to this, and the fact, first of all, they were looking at purposeful discrimination. That was the evil to which the court and Congress were directed in 1965 and 66. But that in any event, in looking at it today, there's a different set of circumstances, and in the reenactment in 1975, there was a different set of circumstances.
It wasn't true in Morgan against Katzenbach, though. The claim there wasn't purposeful discrimination, was it?
No, Mr. Justice Rehnquist, but the claim there was that non-English-speaking people had been intentionally discriminated against with respect to city services, or rather services, governmental services, and that there had been an intentional discrimination of the right to vote previously, but that the particular change, that the particular the literacy requirement had been utilized intentionally, and therefore it was permissible under the congressional fact-finding to outlaw it. Here, to show the court our effect argument, the fact that whether or not Congress can outlaw non-purposeful discriminatory changes, there is no effect here.
Your time has expired now, Mr. Princeton.
Thank you, sir.
Mr. Wallace.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, in our view, very little, if anything, is involved in this case other than faithful application by the district court to the facts before it of the principles established by this court's pertinent decisions.
You feel we made a mistake in noting probable jurisdiction then?
Well, that is not for me to say, Mr. Justice. Probable jurisdiction was noted before the time for filing our response to the jurisdictional statement had expired. Otherwise, the case would have been put over in the summer, and the court made that decision. And I'm not here to question the court's determination of that question. I'm here to state our contentions about what's involved in the case. The rule of retrogression established in Beer against the United States, and we've set out the pertinent quotation in our brief at page 33, was largely determinative of the outcome here as the district court analyzed the case. And I might point out that that rule was developed by this court in the context of a question about the effect of the changes that were involved in Beer. The question of discriminatory purpose had not been reached by the district court in Beer, and therefore was not before this court. It was something to be considered on remand in Beer after this court's decision. So the rule of retrogression was adopted by this court in Beer entirely in the context of the effect test under Section 5. That was the rule applied quite properly here, in our view, by the district court. The kinds of changes at issue here, particularly annexations of predominantly white areas and the imposition of majority vote requirements, where previously there had been election by plurality, and the runoff elections that went along with that, and the imposition of staggered terms, were all devices specifically mentioned in the committee reports accompanying the 1975 extension of the Voting Rights Act as devices threatening diminution of black voting strength.
One of your statements was annexation of predominantly white areas. As I understand it, if one took the population of the area when it was annexed, frequently it was virtually unpopulated.
In 47 of the 60 annexations, the Attorney General pre-cleared them after that became apparent, and his objections were interposed as to only 13 of the 60 annexations that had taken place. With respect to those, there was an addition of, I believe it was 2,000 and some white voters. We have the figures in the brief. But
and did that change the percentage very much?
Not very much, but measurably,
less
Your
than
Honor.
9%?
It was a total of 2%. It was a 1% increase in white registered voters and a 1% decrease in the percentage of black registered voters, for a difference of 2%. We have that set forth in a lengthy footnote in our brief, in which we analyze the statistical evidence. It's on pages 38 and 39, a little bit differently from the way the district court did.
Do you think that ties in with the holding in Richmond?
It does tie in with the holding in Richmond, Mr. Justice, but it ties in even more closely with the holding in City of Petersburg. And in just a moment, I would like to speak further about the annexations. I just want to say, with respect to the other changes, as we pointed out in our brief, unlike the typical Section 5 case, in this case, the district court did not have to predict whether there would be a retrogressive effect as a result of the other changes, because elections had taken place for 8 years under those changes without their having been pre-cleared. And in the 1970 election, in which Reverend Hill, a black candidate to whom counsel for the petitioner referred, ran for office, he would have been elected under the old procedure. Indeed, arguably, he was elected, since the runoff election, a majority vote requirement, had not been pre-cleared and were a nullity. But there's been a subsequent election, so that issue is, for practical purposes, moot. But arguably, he was elected because he received a plurality in the initial vote and then was defeated in the runoff, in which a majority vote was required as a result of the change. So there was no speculation required about whether a retrogressive effect was involved in the changes at issue here. Now, with respect to the annexations, this case, in our submission, differs only in degree and not in any way in principle from the Petersburg case, which was decided summarily by this court in volume 410 U.S. and was referred to extensively in the court's subsequent opinion in City of Richmond. In affirming that judgment, this court necessarily rejected petitioner's basic statutory argument here and implicitly rejected his constitutional argument as well. And for the convenience of the court, in order to clarify this, I have asked the clerk to circulate a Xerox copy of the motion to affirm that was filed by the United States in City of Petersburg and that was granted by seven justices of this court, all of whom are present here.
Isn't it fairly well settled that when we affirm a judgment of district court, we don't affirm the reasoning, we simply affirm the holding?
That the court does not necessarily affirm the reasoning, and that is why I thought it wise to take a look and see whether there is some other conceivable basis for the affirmance, and why I'd like, if the court please, to turn now to pages 6 and 7 of that motion to affirm, because I think that the government there fairly laid bare exactly what was at issue in this appeal, based on the findings that had been made by the district court in the holding there. With the court's leave, I'd like to just read a short passage here. Appellant argues that because the court below found nothing in the annexation which indicated that it had a racial purpose, judicial inquiry in a suit of this nature into the effect on the Negro voter of an extension of the city limits into white suburbia is foreclosed. The plain language of Section 5, however, refutes this argument, and there we quote that the burden is to show that the change does not have the purpose and will not have the effect of denying or abridging the right to vote. Then we say the district court therefore properly did not end its inquiry upon finding that the Petersburg annexation was, quote, a necessary measure to allow the city to expand its tax base and its potential for growth and development. It looked further to ascertain whether, as this court stated in a related context, designedly or otherwise, the extension of the city limits under the circumstances of this particular case would operate to minimize or cancel out the voting strength of racial elements of the voting population.
Well, is it your position that although we do not adopt the opinion of the district court, when we summarily affirm, we adopt the position, the statement of the government's motion to affirm?
Not necessarily, Your Honor, but I believe that by looking at this, the court's recollection will be refreshed as to precisely what was before the court and whether there was some other basis on which affirmance was granted. As a matter of fact, to a large extent, the reasoning of the district court was subsequently endorsed in the City of Richmond opinion. The reason why this decision happens to be more closely on point is because here the district court denied preclearance to the annexation, whereas after appropriate adjustments were made in voting procedures, this court upheld the annexation in the City of Richmond, applying to all appearances, are precisely the same standards on which this denial was based and was affirmed by this court.
Well, it's sort of hard to refresh my recollection because I wasn't here, but on page 8 of your motion, you point out that in that case, the majority white council had been generally unresponsive to the expressed needs and desires of the black community. We have precisely opposite finding in this case, don't we?
Well, I'm aware of that difference between the two cases.
It would have been critical, couldn't it?
There was a different finding here, which arguably could make a difference either in the relief that would be appropriate or in the finding of whether there was a retrogressive effect. But it doesn't make any difference in the basic statutory or constitutional question whether, having found non-discriminatory purpose, indeed a purpose that is referred to in one quotation we have from the opinion in a footnote on page 11 as a compelling need for the annexation, the district court nevertheless was correct in striking it down because the city did not meet the burden of showing that it nonetheless did not have an effect in the absence of ameliorative changes in other voting procedures, in effect proscribed by the Act. It seems to me that is the basic statutory and constitutional contention that is being made on the other side of this case, and which would require rejection of this affirmance. And I would just point out that, again, on pages 10 and 11, we laid bare that that was what was at issue in City of Petersburg. Here, the diminution in the black voting strength resulting from the annexations, although measurable, was obviously less in degree, which is why I say the case differs in degree, but not in principle, from the City of Richmond case. And the district court took proper account of this difference in degree in devising the remedy, or that is, in stating what remedy would be appropriate in order for preclearance to be granted. The pertinent portion of the district court's opinion begins at page 54B in the appendix to the jurisdictional statement. And there the district court looks very properly to the standards spelled out by this court in the City of Richmond case. There was a two-step analysis. The first was that the court found the impact. Because we find the impact on black voting strength to be significant, a measurable retrogressive impact, and we've spelled out the magnitude in that lengthy footnote in our brief, we must inquire further. We must proceed to the second step, whether the black community after the annexations has a fair opportunity to obtain representation reasonably commensurate with its post-annexation numerical strength, which is a paraphrase of the standard adopted by this court in City of Richmond. And while in both City of Richmond and Petersburg, a change to single-member districting was required under the facts of those cases in order to ameliorate the retrogressive effect that the annexations would have. Here, because the effect was less extreme, the court refused to say that that was the only possible way of ameliorating those adverse effects. And as we pointed out in our brief, there are several alternatives that are open to the city to ameliorate those effects. The other changes in voting procedures, particularly the change to majority voting requirement, having been eliminated. As a matter of fact, the Attorney General no longer interposes an objection with respect to the Board of Education elections, no longer interposes an objection to the annexations for that purpose, but only because ameliorative changes of one kind or another should be made with respect to the city commissioner elections. And we have spelled out on pages 40 to 42 of our brief the three possibilities that are open to the city to provide an appropriate amelioration under the standards of City of Richmond.
Why does he treat the Board of Education differently from the City of Commission, City Commission, with respect to annexations?
Well, the difference is because of a residency requirement for City Commission elections, which did not exist under the old procedure for the Board of Education elections. The residency requirement in the context here, as we explain in some detail on page 41, serves the function of a numbered post requirement and results in head-to-head contests that in effect results in a majority vote requirement. As a practical matter, that's been the effect of it. And the residency requirement could either be dropped or adjusted to a requirement based on the three wards that were later adopted rather than the nine wards, as we suggest, so as to ameliorate adverse effect that adding this large number of additional white voters would have on the pre-existing numerical opportunity that black voters had to elect a candidate of their choice, which was demonstrated in the 1970 election when Reverend Hill did win a plurality on the first vote. Now, the statutory standard, as we say, was in our view settled in Petersburg and Richmond, and certainly is described similarly in Beer and in other decisions, and has been endorsed by Congress in the committee reports with respect to the reenactments. And the constitutional power of Congress to adopt those statutory standards was implicitly upheld in all of those decisions. Starting with South Carolina against Katzenbach itself. There really have been four decisions under the Voting Rights Act which show that Congress is not restricted in adopting legislative measures taking action against only what could be proven to be violations of Section 1 of the 15th Amendment. South Carolina against Katzenbach is itself such a decision and has, in common with two others, Gaston County against North Carolina and Oregon against Mitchell, the fact that the court upheld a congressional ban on the use of literacy tests. In Oregon against Mitchell, a wider ban. In Gaston County, the application of the ban to particular circumstances upheld that ban despite the fact that this court had held in Lassiter against North Carolina that the use of literacy tests was not a violation of Section 1 of the 15th Amendment, or at least had not been proven to be a violation of Section 1 of the 15th Amendment such that the courts could strike it down.
In that case,
the congressional province was not really to overrule the court's holding in Lassiter, nor did the court itself find it necessary to re-examine Lassiter. Instead, I think what the court did in all of these cases is very well described, if I may say so, in a paragraph of Mr. Justice Stewart's opinion in Oregon against Mitchell. And I would like to quote this opinion, which was joined by the Chief Justice and Mr. Justice Blackmun, and this is on page 284 of 400 U.S. Because the justification for extending the ban on literacy tests to the entire nation, the claim here was being made by Arizona that the ban on literacy tests should not be extended to it, need not, because the justification for extending the ban on literacy tests to the entire nation need not turn on whether literacy tests unfairly discriminate against Negroes in every state in the Union, Congress was not required to make state-by-state findings concerning either the equality of educational opportunity or actual impact of literacy requirements on the Negro citizens' access to the ballot box. In the interests of uniformity, Congress may paint with a much broader brush than may this court, which must confine itself to the judicial function of deciding individual cases and controversies upon individual records. Compare Lassiter against Northampton Election Board. The findings that Congress made when it enacted the Voting Rights Act of 1965 would have supported a nationwide ban on literacy tests. Instead, at that time, Congress chose to limit its attention to the geographic areas where immediate action seemed necessary, quoting South Carolina against Katzenbach. Experience gained under the 1965 Act has now led Congress to conclude that it should go the whole distance. This approach to the problem is a rational one. Consequently, it is within the constitutional power of Congress under Section 2 of the 15th Amendment. And the eight justices who reached this question under the 15th Amendment, Mr. Justice Douglas upheld it under the 14th Amendment, the eight essentially agreed on this point. The disagreements were on other points. Mr. Justice Black's opinion, Mr. Justice Harlan's opinion, and the joint opinion of Justices Brennan, White, and Marshall were not in disagreement on this basic point about legislative power. There need be a rational nexus to the kind of discrimination that would be a violation of the 15th Amendment, but as Mr. Justice Stewart stated, Congress can paint with a much broader brush. And as we show in our brief, there are really two ways in which this legislation has a rational nexus. One is the fact that it applies in areas where there is reason to presume that in many, perhaps most of the areas in which it applies, there has been purposeful voting discrimination, the effects of which can be perpetuated by changes without this prophylactic device of preclearance provided for in Section 5. And the other is that in light of the findings of racial block voting that were made by the district court in this case, changes can lend themselves to the facilitation and promotion of private purposeful discrimination, and therefore are connected with the principle of Terry against Adams and other decisions of this court under Section 1 of the 15th Amendment. So there are two ways in which there is a wholly adequate legislative nexus here, a rational nexus with purposeful discrimination. And the case, therefore, falls well within the principles this court has previously settled. On the remaining points, we'll rely principally on our brief. It is clear in our view that the changes at issue here were not pre-cleared in 1968 at the time the Attorney General pre-cleared the state law, which didn't make any specific reference to Rome. As this court pointed out in the Sheffield case, which we think is controlling on this point, it bears reemphasizing at the outset that the purpose of Section 5 is to establish procedures in which voting changes can be scrutinized by a federal instrumentality before they become effective. And unless the Attorney General's attention is called to them, the purpose of the Act will not be served. There will be no scrutiny. There was no scrutiny of what changes would occur in the city of Rome. And for reasons expressed in our brief, we believe the Attorney General properly interpreted his regulations with respect for the request for reconsideration that had been submitted to him, and acted in a timely manner under those regulations. And even if he had not, he had nonetheless had interposed an objection within the time specified by the statute. And we don't see why the protections of the statute would be abrogated by tardiness under the regulations in consideration of a request for reconsideration.
Mr. Wallace, may I interrupt? Will you refresh my recollection on how a state may be relieved from the obligation to comply with Section 5? You take the position that a city may not bail out under any circumstances. How does a state get out?
Well, there is a provision in the Act for the bringing of a declaratory judgment action to exempt itself from the coverage.
What must it show?
The provision is set out on page 43 of our brief, Mr. Justice. It must show that no test or device has been used during the 17 years preceding the filing of the action for the purpose or with the effect of denying or abridging the right to vote on account of race or color within the entire covered jurisdiction.
Does that mean if one county failed to comply with that, that the rest of the state would remain under the Act?
That question has not been decided by a court, but so far as I'm aware, that would be the meaning of it, because there's no provision for piecemeal bailouts, which would be, for the reasons we stated, a very impractical way to proceed.
So the smallest unit in a state can keep the entire state under the Act indefinitely?
Well, the Act, of course, is a temporary one.
The Act is temporary?
Well, it was extended by Congress in 1975 for 7 additional years. It presently expires in 1982. Many of the advocates of extension at that time had been advocating a 10-year extension. The Attorney General had advocated a 5-year extension. Congress, after lengthy hearings, determined that 7 years would be the appropriate extension, and I'm sure the question will come up again in 1982.
Mr. Wallace, if you're correct that the city can't bring an action to bail out, and we agree with you, is the case over? Do we reach any other issue?
Well, the city is saying that the district court erred in refusing to pre-clear its changes. It brought an ordinary pre-clearance suit in the district court. So that question is also before this court. Those were separate counts of the complaint, and the district court reached them and decided them against the city.
So we must reach the other issue.
Yes, Mr. Justice.
Thank you, gentlemen. The case is submitted. We'll hear arguments next in National Labor Relations.